She told me not to run away. I run out of water for a million days. I forgot about my name. She took me in when the sandstorms came.
Chapter 5. Anakin leads a crusade against both the Separatists and Republic for clone and droid rights. It wouldn't be an exaggeration to call the Amavikan a third side of the war. The guerrilla tactics and hit-and-run raids against slavers that they use to ensure their own freedom are deployed in almost exactly the same way when it comes to droids and clones. Most of them, when the pirate fleet make contact under the cover of darkness or on quieted and encrypted comms, choose to stay where they are, loyal to the cause or to their companions that they fight beside. But slowly, news about the chips spreads through the Republic Army. Hidden orders are revealed in the code of the droids, and more start doubting their place. In fact, the list of secret commands that the Amavikan slicers find in the chips and in the hidden codes are remarkably similar, leading to suspicions that one and the same person is behind both armies. Annie forwards this information to Padme, thinking she'll be best placed to investigate, as he is very much persona non grata in the environments that the people with the power to arrange a galactic war move in, whereas she moves comfortably in those environments. She, in turn, enlists some of the Jedi that she trusts. They all know where the information originates. Padme's ties to the slave revolution aren't exactly secret, but for the sake of politics, they politely pretend that her source is unknown to them. Droids and clones meet on the battlefield and eye each other warily. The words of the freedom fighters, how each side is made up of slaves who have no choice but to be there, echo in the minds of both sides. Their hands are on their blasters, their guns are in the fire position, but both sides hesitate to fire first, despite the commanders yelling at them. There are reports of droids deliberately missing, or shooting to wound rather than kill, of clones with mechanical skills using them to repair rather than destroy droids, of clones and droids deserting together. The war sputters to a halt. Clones and droids go missing from the battlefields and turn up on the free planets. There is an uneasy truce between clankers and bucketheads that is complicated by the fact that they each killed many companions on both sides. But slowly, warily, they learn to get along. A clone called Slick is discovered to have been feeding information to the pirates about the movements of the fleet. He is imprisoned and scheduled to be tried for treason, but disappears from jail under mysterious circumstances. He's occasionally seen in Anakin Skywalker's crew. His betrayal leads to the freedom of many of his brothers, not their deaths. And it's hard for Cody to condemn him as he should. It doesn't help that he knows his general, Dooku, has some sympathies with the pirates. Palpatine, having gone through several apprentices and killed them all for not being up to his standards, is still looking, and his eye falls on Dooku, who in another life already had devoted years to the dark side by this point, who always had a questioning bent, whose doubts that the Jedi are on the right side are increasing daily. Dooku had these doubts years before, and was on the verge of leaving the Jedi Order once, but in that case, he was brought back. With his Padawan Qui-Gon to anchor him, with a mended relationship with his master Yoda, with a firm friendship with Jocasta Nu, he is in a better and more secure position than he was in another story. Still, Chancellor Palpatine raises some valid points. Palpatine's greatest gift left has always been his skill at reading people and knowing which buttons to press. The Republic is corrupt. The Jedi are stagnating. And the dark is spreading. The Clone Rights Bill is stuck in the Senate, where it has been for the past 2.5 years. The Republic is in an alliance with the Hutts, and working against the free people. Ornfree Tah, the slaving senator from Ryloth, is still in the Senate. Not as a senator, he's been replaced by freedom fighter Shams Syndulla, but as a representative and advisor. He is still of value to the banking clan, and there are many seats he can bribe himself into. And the fact that the banking clan has so much political power is in itself a searing indictment of the failure of democracy in the Republic. Ornfree Tah holds a high administrative post and receives a very competitive salary paid by the Republic, since he knows people. Has friends in high places. And even though his value depreciated somewhat when the slave trade on Ryloth was actually, as opposed to officially, dismantled, he still has lucrative business interests. It makes Dooku sick. And that is what Palpatine exploits. But he can't press too hard. Can't openly propose Dooku should support the Separatists. Palpatine is still the Supreme Chancellor of the Republic, and Dooku still reports to the Jedi. But he exerts his subtle manipulations. But the war is going rather too well for the Republic for Palpatine to be entirely comfortable, and he can see the end is in sight. Already there are movements calling on him to give up his emergency powers, which is the opposite of what he wants. The Delegation of 2000, which existed as a small clandestine group in another story, is the Delegation of 2700 in this story, and they are canvassing support from others, allies Palpatine has up until now always been able to count on. He is in no place to proclaim himself emperor. So he pushes Dooku a little too hard, a little too fast. Dooku is clever, and he puts this together with the information the Jedi were given from that naive senator from Naboo about one person being behind both the Separatists and the Republic, playing both sides against each other, and comes up with the correct answer. He doesn't know that Palpatine is a Sith, not yet. But he takes his suspicions to the Jedi, nonetheless. Dooku hasn't been groomed since he was a child. There is no pregnant wife to hold over his head. He doesn't fall for Palpatine's promises of extended life. One cut with a lightsaber, and Darth Sidious is no more. Palpatine never could pick his apprentices. But Palpatine does manage to do one thing before Dooku lands the killing blow. He sends an order out across the galaxy to execute Order 66. He tells the clones to kill all the Jedi. And the clones turn on their generals. And fire. But not all. Many clones have already deserted to the free planets, but many more have had their chips removed quietly under the table and returned to their brothers, serving in the army not because they had to, not because they'd been ordered and delivered like a product ready to consume and discard when done with, but because they chose to. They returned for their brothers, for their generals, for the Republic that didn't deserve their loyalty but sometimes had it all the same, and that was their choice. Some set their blasters to stun before they fire, Some turn their blasters and fire on their brothers. Some step in to shield those who they had served under, bled for, but also served with and bled with. Good soldiers follow orders, but not when the orders are wrong. They have agency. They can choose which orders to follow. Siri Tachi and her Padawan Ferris Olin, a gifted slicer, managed to get the halt order sent out. It takes them 15 endless minutes. In that time, almost 100 Jedi lose their lives. It's too many lives lost. It's not the thousands of another story. The Jedi Order survives. The just over 800 clones who lose their lives, either to Jedi lightsabers or to their own blasters after they regain control of their thoughts and actions, are also mourned, but as an afterthought. When the news of Palpatine's duplicity is released to the public, the war is finally over. The Republic is destabilized. The legitimacy of the Senate is in question. There is a massive war debt. And the infrastructures and economies of the worlds where most of the fighting took place are crippled. The Separatists are facing many of the same problems, and they're not much better off. Nobody really knows what to do. So both coalitions break up into smaller parts slowly. There is no war against planets that want to secede on either side, and nobody claims them for their coalitions with force. And, on a related note, there is the problem of what to do with the millions of droids and clones built and bred solely to serve as soldiers in this sham war. Those who haven't already defected to the free planets. Very little of this affects the Skywalkers or the Free Planets, aside from finding places to live and work for all the incoming clones and droids. They play on a different arena. Republic or Separatist, Jedi or Sith, it matters little to them. A slaver is a slaver, no matter how they pretty it up. With the Republic splitting up, Annie is given an official pardon by several systems that don't practice slavery. And that means that he and Padme can finally be open with their relationship. They marry in secret on Tatooine, with the Tatooine rituals of sharing bread, salt, and water, and they whisper their vows in each other's ears so that nobody but they can hear them. Then they go to Shmi to get her blessing, as the matriarch of Anakin's community. She gives it, gladly. She's watched both Annie and Padme grow up into caring, steadfast, honest people, driven by a passion for justice and concern for the powerless. She recites the blessing of the mother, and then the Amavikans celebrate with bonfires and dancing through the night. This is the first time Padme has seen Nimdara performed, and she is not certain if the dance is choreographed or if the dancers are actually that in sync with each other. Only occasionally did slaves get these public celebrations, and they take any opportunity they have these days. Ben tells the story of Marvsta Darklighter, who tricked their Dapur into selling them to the Dapur of their love, and so they could be together. He has little Biggs Darklighter on his hip, who may or may not be a descendant of Marvsta. Darklighter, like White Sun and Skywalker, is one of the names slaves take when they are sold too early to remember their own name and have to name themselves. He has one arm around his sister, Lefana, who has come with Beru, Owen, and Cleeg to Mos Espa from their farm. Beru is visibly pregnant. Many children are born in the months and years just following the liberation of Tatooine. They then have a ceremony on Naboo, with Padme dressed in white, presided over by a priest from Naboo. The reception on Naboo is attended by hundreds of people. Even though Naboo is a fairly unimportant mid-rim planet, Padme herself is an important senator and key to the peace talks. And Annie is also, in his own way, a big deal. There are several Jedi in attendance, both because Padme Amidala is a vocal supporter of the Jedi Order, and because they are friends of the bride. But Qui-Gon Jinn attends proudly as a friend also of the groom and his family. Ben manages to avoid all but the most fleeting and polite contact with any Jedi. He is still not ready to be discovered by them. He doesn't know if he ever will be. It's somewhat amusing to see the core and inner rim politicians so deeply uncomfortable at being at the same event as the smugglers and pirates and freed slaves of the outer rim, yet trying not to show it. Trying to show sensitivity, yet coming off as condescending without realizing it. There's a contrast here between the informal celebrations in Mos Espa, the potluck dinner followed by bonfires and dancing, and the elaborate Nubian procession and feast. They have music of complex harmonies and poetry that weaves itself around the stanzas. The flowers match Annie's and Padme's clothes, and the menu has been carefully selected weeks in advance. The Amavikan do perform one song, a fairly simple call-and-response work song in basic, the kind that's sung to keep several people in sync to a steady rhythm. Not Amataka. And not one that contains any kind of incendiary message against the Hutts. Not one with secret information on the Freedom Trail. Those things are still kept deeply secret. It was only after Padme had been Anakin's fiancée for some time that she started to learn just how many secrets the slaves kept. She's not sure the visiting dignitaries and politicians understand the honor they're being shown, or the importance of this event. Amavikan culture being displayed in public, this culture that has been closely guarded since the very first slave on Tatooine. Anakin Skywalker never falls. Where does he have to fall from? He's not a Jedi. He's not the Chosen One. Or maybe he is, but chosen by the Mother of Mothers. Chosen by the Amavikan people. Chosen by himself. He's not held to standards that he can't meet. And he has a solid grasp of who and what he is. He's a pirate, a smuggler, a freedom fighter, a leader. He's a son, a brother, a husband, a friend. When he has troubling dreams, he turns to Shmi, to Ben, to Padme. Annie is a true dreamer, they know this, and they take appropriate care. His true dreaming is treated like any other capability, the same way he and Ben can lift things at a distance. The same way Beru always knows where to find water in the desert. The same way Lefana never loses her footing. They are all gifts from Aramu, and they are all worth treasuring. Annie's true dreaming means they shore up defenses at Haven before a clan of disgruntled Tusken attack. They mean Shmi takes care not to go out alone for some weeks, until they find the bounty hunter who is targeting her. Annie's dreams are useful, and they take them seriously. Annie still fears loss. He will always get attached deeply to people and cling with all his might. But he has lost friends, brothers, sisters, in a way he won't as a Jedi. More connections to people also mean more people who can be taken from you. Slaves have the same mourning rituals for someone who has been sold as someone who has died. Annie is no stranger to loss. He knows that even if it hurts, even if it feels as if his soul is on fire, as if he can't make it to the next day, he will. he can come through it on the other side. And even if he will never heal, will never be the same as he was before, he will still make it through. He has Shmi, Ben, Kitster, Amy, Melly, Slick, Baru, and everyone else in his extended family to help him through it when the time comes. He doesn't dream about Padme dying. He never goes to precisely the wrong person to try and save her. He's not groomed since childhood to not trust those closest to him. The Tatooinians are invited to meet with the Senate on Coruscant, ostensibly to negotiate hyperlanes, again, but really so they can lay out the benefits of Republic membership, again. The Republic is desperate for new members to replace all the ones they have lost. Ben is part of the delegation, as one of the best negotiators the Tatooinians have. Shmi has elected to stay on Tatooine, her home, the place where she has spent all her life. The Jedi, still in their role as the negotiators and diplomats of the Republic, even if that role is being increasingly questioned by the Senate and by the Jedi themselves, are there to meet Ben as he descends the ramp of the spacecraft that brought him here. It's Annie's ship, of course. Annie would trust nobody else to take his brother to the core for the first time in decades. Qui-Gon and Dooku are there, to honor their previous acquaintance with Ben and the Skywalker family. Yoda is there to represent the Jedi Council. He rarely leaves the temple, so that he has made his way all the way to the spaceport shows the Skywalkers a great honor. Ben isn't supposed to know exactly how much of an honor it is that Yoda would leave the temple for them, but he does. They exchange pleasantries, and Ben thinks he manages to hide his nerves. At least well enough that Annie doesn't feel pressured to step in, which is reassuring. He'd never hear the end of it if he had to be saved by his little brother on a diplomatic mission. Annie makes a point not to call any of the Jedi Master. If they're bothered by it, they don't let on. Ben keeps his face pleasant, the small talk light, even as his instincts are screaming at him to watch out, to get out of there now. When the dart comes flying out of nowhere, he's prepared. He dodges. When the red lightsaber ignites behind him, he already has his blaster out. He doesn't recognize the being wielding it. A human male, youngish. Sidious never did follow the rule of two. He always had backup plans to his backup plans, including ones factoring in the event of his death. The man is hopelessly outclassed against three Jedi Masters and a half dozen pirates. He still manages to slice Qui-Gon's hand off. It lands on the ground with a metallic clang, and his lightsaber falls out of his hand. It lands by Ben's feet, almost like a sign. Ben hasn't dedicated his life to listening to the Force. He has had other concerns in his life. But he can still recognize when it's screaming at him. He hasn't held a lightsaber in almost 3 decades, but it fits in his hand as if it were made for him. His body falls automatically back into the stances he worked so hard on when he was an initiate. He borrows most heavily from Atoru, the form he is most familiar with, but it's been changed from years of non-standard katas, from sparring with Annie on the loose sand dunes of Tatooine, from learning Nimdara, from calling on the Force in new ways not taught to the Jedi initiates, but discovered on his own through experimentation. It both is and isn't anything like messing about with sticks and table legs and droid parts with Annie. The lightsaber has its own echo, responds to what he wants it to do almost before he knows it himself. The Force hums with every swing, and he thinks, yes, yes, this is what he was meant to do. This is who he was meant to be. He makes it look effortless. effortless. And Qui-Gon can only look on as the young man he dismissed as a slightly Force-sensitive, unassuming slave on a backwater planet holds off the Sith apprentice as if he were born to it. His fighting is unorthodox, but he clearly has some Jedi training, and Qui-Gon wonders where in the world he picked it up. Who would teach a slave Jedi katas? Ben manages to work with both Yoda and Dooku, and lines the Sith up so Dooku can strike the finishing blow. In this story, Dooku has killed more Sith than any other Jedi. Qui-Gon will never voice his theory that Dooku is so intent on killing Sith as a way to combat the darkness that he himself has wrestled with. Qui-Gon isn't even supposed to know that Dooku has had those troubles. Ben hands Qui-Gon's saber back with an almost Jedi-like bow. "My apologies for the presumption," he says, "and my thanks for the loan. Are you well?" Qui-Gon takes the proffered hand and stands up. Yes, I'm fine. Nothing damaged but my pride." "And your hand," Ben points out. Annie's poking at it, trying to see what upgrades have been made since the last time you saw it. And Ben inwardly cringes at the rudeness. "It can be replaced. But I should be thanking you. You saved my life. I didn't know you knew the art of the lightsaber." Ben waves the apology away. "You Jedi would have managed just fine without me." Yoda, who up until now has remained silent, speaks up.
"Obi-Wan Kenobi,"
he says, leaning his chin on his walking stick.
"Thought you dead, Reed. In hiding you have been."
Ben stills. Annie, intimately attuned to his brother's moods, drops Qui-Gon's hand and puts his hand back on his blaster, even though this threat is not one they can shoot themselves out of. Annie's always been more eager to fight his way out than Ben. His adventures in piracy have only made him more so. If in doubt, shoot something. Most of the time it works, but the other times, it really, really doesn't. "Obi-Wan Kenobi," Ben says thoughtfully, to buy himself some time. Now there's a name I haven't heard in a long time. Most know me as Ben Skywalker. And other than preferring a different name, I haven't been hiding. You haven't been looking, Jedi Master Yoda. It comes out as slightly more aggressive and bitter than he intends it to, and he can feel Annie's hand reach out and take his arm. It's reassuringly warm through the thin cloth. He doesn't make any outward sign that he notices, but he knows Annie can tell how grateful he is.
"Disclose your identity, you did not,"
Yoda harumphs.
"Though known Qui-Gon for many years, you have."
Ben nods once, conceding the point. "True. But I doubt this is a discussion either of us wants to have so openly." The silence hangs heavy between them on the way back to the Jedi Temple. In the temple, Ben points out many of his childhood haunts to Annie, who listens with interest, and tries to imagine himself and Ben among the serene halls of the Jedi. He doesn't have much success. Ben seems like so much more than would fit in here. True, he has himself under tight control, keeps his thoughts to himself, and can convince anyone of anything. But he is also a thrill-seeker, just like Annie himself, makes reckless plans, and when he succeeds through luck calls it skill, and will happily ditch his principles by the wayside if it will help him achieve a larger goal. Ben would be smothered by the Jedi Order. Annie also tries to see himself here, and has even worse success. Annie is not a Jedi. Annie is a storm. He is Akrath. He prefers a blaster over any other weapon, and his main go-to solution to problems is to shoot at them. From what he knows of the Jedi, he can see a fairly obvious culture clash there, and that's just the start. Annie may have idealized the Jedi as a child, but that time is firmly past, and he is more grateful than he can express that his mother and brother did not let Qui-Gon take him away from his family as a child. Qui-Gon can hardly believe what he is hearing. Obi-Wan Kenobi, the boy who was almost his apprentice, the boy he rejected and who died so soon afterwards, is standing in front of him, alive and well. Has, in fact, been alive and well, for given values of well, for all this time. And Qui-Gon knew him without ever knowing. How did he not recognize the boy? "It's my fault," he says, as soon as they reach a somewhat secluded room to speak in. "I'm truly sorry I didn't recognize you, and I hold myself to blame for all of it. I've known you for so many years, counted you as a friend, and yet I had no idea of your true identity. I should have recognized you on Tatooine. I should have rescued you. If only you'd said something. Of course I'd brought you back to the temple and taken you as my own apprentice. You and your brother, we would have made space for both of you." He looks to Yoda and Dooku as if daring them to disagree. They don't. Ben sighs, and then figures he might as well say what he has been thinking. It'll take up everyone's thoughts until it's dealt with. He takes a deep breath, drawing strength from his brother beside him. "That's precisely why I didn't say anything. You would have taken me, but you wouldn't have done anything for the rest of the slaves. You would have rescued Obi-Wan Kenobi, but you weren't willing to rescue Ben Skywalker. And by that point, I'd been Ben Skywalker for over half my life. I didn't know how not to be. Why did Obi-Wan Kenobi deserve to be rescued but not Ben Skywalker? And truthfully, I couldn't bear it if you had brought me back to the council chamber and said I was still too old and too angry. I'd already been rejected once, and I had no reason to think you wouldn't reject me again. I know myself. I am everything you accused me of. Impulsive, angry, attached. If anything, my years on Tatooine made me more so, not less. And you were so obviously interested in Annie, who was even more impulsive, angry, and attached than I was at his age. What would his future be if you brought him back and rejected him like you had me? Or what if you'd taken him? Taken him and taught him Jedi calm, taught him to let go of his attachments, made him turn away from his native culture. You take younglings so early, most of them don't have time to absorb an identity. But for Annie, you don't know how deeply the slave culture goes. You would have had him give up everything he was, get rid of his entire identity to fit in. And you would have smothered him. So I hid my past, and let you think I was nothing more than a slave with some sensitivity to the Force. I discouraged your interest in Annie, because I couldn't risk myself or him. I weighed the benefits of freedom against the cost of our identity, our dream of freeing every slave on Tatooine, and decided it wasn't worth it. It goes against everything he is to lay himself bare like this. Ben's every instinct is to guard himself closely, not to let on what he knows or feels. Only Annie knows what this outburst cost him. The Jedi say nothing for a while, in the face of Ben's rather extended grievances. "I am truly sorry for what we did to you, for our blindness," Qui-Gon says at last.
change there will be,
Yoda agrees. Ben shrugs. I won't say things turned out for the best, because truthfully things were pretty terrible for a long time, but I did a lot of good, probably more than I would have as a Jedi. We eliminated slavery, and I was a part of it when you were complicit. They haven't forgiven the Republic or the Jedi for the way they used the clones during the wars, and most likely they will always carry a grudge. The clones say the Jedi were doing the best of a bad situation, which, if they're honest, is the only reason they'll deal with them at all. Ben is firmly disillusioned with the Jedi Order. He tells the Jedi that he's happy where he is, doing what he was meant to be doing. He doesn't carry a grudge, but also doesn't absolve the Jedi Order for what they did to him and other initiates who were deemed too old or unsuitable in other ways. They meet with some of Ben's childhood friends. It's every bit as awkward as Ben always imagined it would be, after the joyful revelation that he was alive. Their lives have simply diverged too much. They have too little in common. But when Ben goes home, he has their contact details, and they start up correspondence that slowly bridges the distance between them, and they start to relearn each other as adults. The Jedi Order starts to work on reforming the way they treat younglings, starting with the routines for younglings who are not chosen as Padawans, spearheaded by Qui-Gon and Yoda, which surprises many people, as Yoda has always been a traditionalist. But the Jedi Order has always been slow and resistant to reform. The work Qui-Gon and Yoda are starting will be the work of several generations. But in time, even the Jedi Order will find its way again. Ben goes home, which in this story is not the Jedi Temple, but a small house in what used to be the slave quarters of Mos Espa. He belongs on Tatooine, with his mother and his many brothers and sisters. Annie's children, Luke and Leia, twins, are born free to a Tatooine with no slaves. Beru and Owen have their second child soon after, and Kitster and Wald adopt several orphans. Even though slavery is ended, there are still many children who don't know who or where their parents are. Annie settles down on Naboo with Padme, who has a role as an advisor to the Queen after she steps down from the Senate. Melly takes over the running of the ship, bringing up her son Biggs as she takes over the captain's role. Her ship is by now mostly reputable, and they do mainly legal work. They take on passengers and somehow pick up a reputation as a reliable spice freighter of all things. But they still do some smuggling, and they will never stop seeking out people in need of help. Luke, Leia, and Biggs travel all over the galaxy, picking up a mishmash of languages. Amataka and Basic are their first languages. Trelleki, Bocce, Hattese, Mantoa, and Shriwook come soon after. After finally offloading most of the administration of Tatooine onto others, Ben joins the crew occasionally for the odd job. Luke, Leia, and Biggs grow up as siblings. They grow up surrounded by a large family of cousins, sisters, brothers, siblings, and friends. They spend most of their time on Naboo or on Melly's ship. They look forward to the times when they sit down on Tatooine, especially Luke, who gets on the best with Owen and Beru's children. Luke, who in another life couldn't wait to escape. This is a new story. It's a story about a young boy who finds a home and a family in dark circumstances. About a man who swears to never again call anyone master and keeps his promise. About a woman who lives long enough to hold her grandchildren. It's a story about people claiming their freedom. About the light found in dark places. and about bonds that last through hardship and distance. It's a story of pain, but also of love. And on the whole, it's a good one. The end. Reader's Notes. This podfic was recorded for Melancholy Morningstar as part of ITPE 2020. Hot damn! 10 years of this! Oh, I'm so excited. So Melancholy Morningstar asked for time travel shenanigans, which time travel do-overs where one person gets to go back in time and fix things, and it's not quite that, but I loved how in story there is the comparison between the story you know and the story you're getting, and how all the ways that like tiny changes are causing sort of a fix-it effect on everything. You had also asked for clone rights and droid rights, which this story does have, and Tatooine slave culture, which this story 5,000% has, and Ventress kicking ass and taking names, Ventress being an amazing lesbian space witch. She has a cameo in this story, and when I found out that basically Ventress stays on Ratatak and, like, finds her way to liberating as many people as she can by also slicing them open, like, that... The idea of the mini sort of storytelling that I filled in for Ventress's backstory in this universe is glorious, and I don't know that I'm going to say any of it, but basically it's like, she does have her moment with Kynarik, and she has her adorable tiny flippy hair like a baby Hot Topic that I love so much, and then he dies. But just because she's angry doesn't necessarily mean that she finds her way into, you know, another master-apprentice situation. Asajj decides to chart her own course in this universe, and that little cameo gives me so much joy. Also, the cameo of Suratachi living. if Obi-Wan's not there, Qui-Gon doesn't go on that mission. Siri lives! Yay. Yeah, the Tatooine slave culture and the freedom trail, and I'm just like, the familyness of it all! The found family, that was the other thing you asked for, and I feel like this universe, there is a lot of found family. And I was so incredibly delighted to find out that Chronic Bookworm has blanket permission to podfic, because I'd had this in my sort of mark for later for a really long time and just hadn't gotten around to it. But when I was looking for potential ITPEs, like, this seemed perfect, and then the fact that it was BP was even more perfect, and I'm just really glad that I can help put my spin on this lovely sort of shared headcanon of how things work in Tatooine when not everything is shit on a stick. I also found that the storytelling style just felt really fun to record, because it is very, like, it's not the same style of prose that other podfic is sort of written as. So this was just like a really cool creative excursion. And also, this story has kicked me out of my month-long pod vlog. So thank you, Melancholy Morningstar, for giving me prompts to work off of so that I can actually record words. It feels good. I've been creatively constipated for over a month and I needed this so badly. Thank you. Yes. Anyway, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Have a nice day.
She told me not to run away. I was lost in the desert for a million days. I forgot about my name. She took me in when the sandstorms came.